We have a plan for to drill a lucky shot.
Okay.
Give us 2 years, to get that project, 2, 3 years, get that project where we want it to be to be able to produce. We're using the direct shipping model. And then Johnson Tracts are 2, 3 years behind that. So I call it kind of a 5-year plan to get both those projects up and running. And if when they're up and running, as we envision them, this is a company that can be producing, 200, 230,000 ounces of gold a year.
Rick Van Nieuwenhuyzen. Did I say that?
This is pretty good.
This is pretty good. Contango Ore, how are you?
Good, good. On our way to New Orleans.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming to Atlanta. Shout out to Three Taverns Brewery for hosting us here in Atlanta. Really, I'll name drop. I talked to Rick about you, and he wasn't aware until right before I was going to bring you up. I just asked if I can talk to him about you. He said, yeah. And what was really attractive about Contango Ore, the first thing, there were two things. One was one of your projects, but the first thing was you. So I want to talk about you for a little bit. Give us some of your background and also give you some context. I met you about, it was about 5 months ago in Florida, and it was this very charismatic, if you would, person that I met, you, and also somebody that really knew Alaska. And as a former Alaskan, that meant a lot to me. So how did you end up in Alaska?
Well, Alaska is one of those places that always seems to just draw you in. People, either when they go there, they either love it or they hate it. What they usually hate is the darkness in the wintertime. So my background, I was born in Belgium, hence the long Dutch name. We immigrated to Canada when I was about 5 and then moved to Alaska when I was about 11. So I grew up in Alaska. That's what I call home. I like it up there. I don't mind the dark and don't mind the cold, and it's a wonderful place to be a geologist, and it's a wonderful good place to be in business for mineral resources, because it's definitely one of the 5 pillars of the economy. It's oil and gas, mining, timber, fish, and tourism. So that's what we do in Alaska, and mining's right up there. I started a number of companies up there. We started the Nova Gold. Made a huge discovery at Donlin, partnered with Barrick. It's been a big success. We had Trilogy Metals. We've done some things in the Yukon with Alexco in developing the Keno Hill mine. We sold that to Hecla a while back. I'm a geologist by background. I love the business of the exploration. It is a business. I think a lot of geologists lose sight of that. Especially geologists who are running companies. I think they get in the habit of drilling drill holes and not thinking about the overall business. So I can be very critical of my fellow geologists at time for that reason, because I think you have to keep in mind that it is a business and that you're working for the shareholders, not to have a great time out in the field.
So let's pin that thought, because I couldn't agree more with you. And that's kind of the issue that I have with exploration companies, mining companies, juniors. And I don't even know if I call you a junior anymore. That all being said, I'd like to work that out a little bit more in just a little bit. But I want to stay on you and your background. You grew up in Alaska. You went to West High School in Anchorage, right?
Go Eagles.
1972 graduate.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. And where did you go to college? And you ended up working for Placer Dome, if I'm not mistaken. And again, I'm going from memory.
Yeah. So I, after high school, went back to Belgium to go to university there, University of Leuven, and one of the oldest universities in Europe, actually. Very strict Catholic school. I didn't go there for the Catholicism. I went there because it was a really good school and it was free. You had to pass tests to get in, qualifying tests and all that, but education is higher education in Belgium is free. So got a good solid education there, math science background, became a minor in physics. And then went to graduate school, University of Arizona in Tucson. And then worked in Alaska all the summers, starting with a company called Bear Creek Mining Company, which is the exploration arm of Kennecott, and then worked for Anaconda for a number of years and got a good solid foundation. Anaconda was a company that really believed in mentorship. So was, put underneath a couple of really sharp guys in the business, John Proffitt and a fellow by the name of Dick Cavallaro. Good structural mapping, good field mapping, good, core logging skills. And that's what, kind of got me started and got me excited about exploration and about the business of exploration itself.
So that's a great point, and let's pin that as well, because that's going to play out in another question that I have, really with the direction of the company and some of the projects that you're working on right now. So, So from there, I remember when I talked to you in Florida, you told me you were working, I think your background, and this is all I knew of you at the time, was a placer dome. How did you go from there back to Alaska running your own thing?
So in 1980, and in the early 80s, a couple of things happened. Alaska kind of shut down as an exploration venue because of an act called the MILCA, Alaska National Interest Landscape Act, which pretty much set in motion a 20-year process by which the federal government was going to select land, the state was going to select land, and the Native Corporation was going to select land. So they divvying up Alaska, but while they were divvying it up, nobody really wanted to spend a lot of the money exploring. You just didn't know who your landlord was going to be, basically. So it kind of shut down. That happened, and then the other thing that happened in the shoe that dropped was that Anaconda was sold to ARCO when I still worked there, and then a few years later was basically sold for parts. So this is a company that was at the pinnacle of the United States mining industry in the 70s and 60s, 60s, 70s, but by the mid-80s was gone. Just I sold for parts, and that was kind of the end of an era. So it was a bit of an eye opener for me as a young geologist, like, boy, what happened here?
Spike.
Right. Overnight, this fantastic company was a great approach to exploration, at least from my perspective. And like you said, the mentorships and all that just disappear. And anyway, so that was it was a good learning experience. I worked in Nevada for a number of years, and then basically got doing some work for Placer Dome on a contract. And then they asked me to come back to Alaska. This would have been the early, end of the 80s, early 90s. And so that's when I started working for Placer as the regional manager for Alaska. And then eventually became VP of exploration for an oddball district that was Alaska, Africa, Asia outside of China. That was handled by the Australians and Europe. So I got to travel an awful lot, see lots of different deposits and lots of different jurisdictions, and also interact with government officials in different jurisdictions. So you kind of saw a lot of different varieties of how do you do business in different places. Lots are the same. Doesn't matter where you go, lots are the same. But how you approach doing business in those different jurisdictions can, vary a lot. So got to learn a lot, I guess.
We threw Contango War, the founding of that. How did that all happen? And yeah.
Yeah. So my involvement in Contango comes in sort of post-discovery. They had made the discovery. It's a bit of a funny story, but they actually were invited by the Tetlin tribe to come up and explore their lands for gas, natural gas, because ConocoPhillips was going to build a gas pipeline from North Slope down to northern BC and build a ginormous LNG plant. This was all kind of the rage back in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And first by about 2008 or so, that just sort of played out. I think there was something called the world financial crisis that occurred.
Never thought I remember it.
But for a period of time that was what was going to happen. And so the Tetlin tribe, the pipeline would have gone right across Tetlin lands. And so the tribe said, well, we don't really trust ConocoPhillips to tell us if we have any gas on our land because they have all this gas in the North Slope and not going to be terribly interested. But so we'll go get some wildcatters from Texas to come up and explore our lands.
Wow.
For the gas. So that's how this whole thing got started. So they invited Brad Juneau up, and who was our chairman, to evaluate the lands for gas. And they signed an agreement. In very short order, they figured out that these were all high-grade metamorphic rocks. So there's like zero chance any gas anywhere close to here. But they quickly pivoted, being good entrepreneurial Texans. They quickly pivoted and hired a good friend of mine, Kurt Freeman, who had an exploration contract company. And so he basically took on all the exploration programs for Contango on behalf of Contango. And they, you know, nothing happens overnight, but they did reconnaissance work. You have to appreciate that the Tetlin tribe had never invited anybody to do any exploration on these lands, including the USGS and the Alaska Department of Geological Sciences. So this was really grassroots exploration. So they did, you know, stream sediment sampling, follow-up, and they eventually found what is now the deposit, the Manh Choh project, and outlined a resource, and did this fairly quickly. But then they're like, well, now what do we do with that?
Yeah.
And sort of just, you know, fast forward, not to get into all the nitty gritty details, but they asked me to come on and to do something with this nice project. And, you know, they knew my background. Kurt knew me a long time. We had the best laid plans to consolidate 100% of the project because they'd subsequently formed a joint venture with Royal Gold. So Royal Gold owned 40% and Contango owned 60%. The idea was to consolidate back into 100% and then go approach Kinross. We allowed Kinross to buy the 40% because we had a first right of refusal on it. And then we sold them 30% of our 60. So that gave them 70-30. So, and that business arrangement just made more sense to me and to us when I convinced the board of is we'd rather have a small piece of something that we know we can get done because the capital costs were relatively modest since we weren't building a mill and a tailings facility. And we knew, you know, we weren't going to have huge permitting challenges. It's private land owned by the tribe. The tribe's 100%, 120% supportive of developing the mine. So, you know, that's kind of the short story of how that got going and why it got going, again, relatively quickly from sort of start to finish of forming the joint venture to getting our first gold pour earlier this year.
Well, it's a great story, and there's a lot in that story. And there's the business side, but there's also the relationship side. And I want you to, if you could, talk more about working with the tribe, navigating that. And that just must be a great honor that they trusted you to come and work that. Tell me about that. And that really means a lot to me because of the respect that you have. And I'm not singling out this tribe, but just in general, just for people, if you would, and being respectful and giving them a very fair and honest context, if you would.
So working with Alaska tribes and there are tribes, there are corporations, there are regional corporations, there's village yep. corporations. So there's a political end of that and there's a business end of that. And they definitely overlap.
Right.
More so than in your typical corporation. And it just, you know, I guess having grown up there sort of understanding the history of how the Alaska Native Corporations came about, and Tetlin is unusual in that it's one of the only large areas, in Alaska where the tribe owns a lot of land. Typically the tribes don't own much land, if any land. The corporations do, village
right.
corporations and regional corporations, but not tribes. Anyways, not to get into the weeds there, but having grown up in Alaska and having for a very long period of time worked with a lot of different Native organizations, because you also have nonprofit organizations in there, that just gives you a feel for what they want, what are they looking for, and how do you approach getting them there? We all said early on in our working with the different Alaska Native groups, meet early, meet often. And it's a good thing to do that. There is a challenge in that you don't have all the answers. Yeah. If you're meeting early, you're especially for exploration, you don't know how this is going to turn out. So a lot of the questions go to what what are you building? I said, how big is it going to be? And how many people are you going to employ? And so you have to, you know, you just have to have those good, honest, open dialogue and maintain the dialogue, but also, you know, maintain a level of anticipation that you know, you don't want to get people excited about visiting your mine next year because it's, you know, you explain it's going to take, you know, 2 or 3 years to permit, it's going to take to raise the capital, all this stuff. So it's, yeah, you've got to sort of moderate yourself as well. You can't overpromise and underdeliver that. You can't do that for stock markets, but you also can't do that with community interests as well. So,
yeah, just being honest and open with people. Sandy,
you know, one of the things I think is important, their chief wants to meet with your chief. Mm-hmm. And so me going there, me going to small villages and sleeping on the gym floor, because that's the only place to sleep, that means a lot.
Absolutely.
And what I see far too often in Alaska, and I'm sure this is probably the same in a lot of jurisdictions, is, you know, the head honchos fly in on the morning flight and fly out on the afternoon flight, or they fly their own plane in, they fly their own plane out. They don't stay overnight.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference to people.
Sure.
You get to know them and they get to know you a bit more. You know, just sitting out, hanging out and, you know, sharing a meal and those kind of things just mean a lot more. And then you're talking about villages that have, you know, 200-300 people out of them.
Yeah.
So it's not hard to get to know everybody. And, you know, for that, you go talk to 10 people and those 10 people talk to, you know, 10 more people, we pretty much got the village covered.
Yeah.
After two or three conversations.
It also seems like, and I mean this in the very best way, it's just basic humanity, getting to know people and treating them like you want to be treated.
It's funny because their concerns are the same concerns we all have. You want, fundamentally, I always kind of boil it down to, most people, if they have kids, they want a better life for their kids. And that's kind of what drives them. And so when they have concerns, they have questions, that's usually where it's coming from. And everybody can understand that. So it isn't rocket science.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of outside influences, and Alaska's a great place for NGOs to raise money. It's they can take one picture and, you know, you're going to ruin this place. And even if that place is like 200 miles from what you're actually talking
about. Right. Yeah. So, I have some stories about that, I'll tell you.
Yeah. But that is what we deal with. And so it's definitely part of the landscape that you have to navigate.
Yeah. So let's talk about the business. Is you a little, I guess, tell me a little bit. I want to delve a little bit deeper into that. You cut a deal where it was a 60-40, and now it's a 70-30. And why did you cut that deal? And how has it worked out for Contango?
Yeah. So basically, having Royal Gold as a former partner. And Royal Gold's a royalty company, so they're not supposed to be operators.
Right.
And so getting an operator in was a key part of my my interest. Like I said, I wanted to get consolidated 100% before going and talking to Kinross, but COVID kind of screwed that up. But we ended up with, you know, a deal that makes sense. And the reason we wanted Kinross in there is because we knew they had an underutilized mill at Fort Knox, and that this ore could afford the transportation to the Fort Knox mill.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the motivation and the driver.
I'm always sidetracked on that conversation.
But, we started, actually the first discussion was at Roundup in Vancouver in January, and then we signed the agreement in September. So, you know, literally it took almost 9 months to get a deal done. And normally I think it would have taken like 3 months,
you know,
under more normal circumstances.
Well, about that, when I met you, you poured your first golds, and I wished you congratulations, but then we talked about the permitting process and you got permitted. I want to say, please correct me if I'm wrong, it was less than a year. And I was just absolutely shocked. And what was stood out to me is you have this business model, if you would, I shouldn't say if you would, you have this business model where it's early permitted and you're cash flowing quickly. And to me, that niche that immediately got me very interested. because you're not going to be burning through. It's just obvious. You're not going to be burning through a whole lot of money. So as a shareholder, that's what I want. Where's my money being spent?
Yep.
And you're being a very good steward of my money. So tell me about that right now, not so much share structure, but tell me about the cash flow that you have coming in. And I was reading your company reports. This was based on, I want to say, 2100 gold, a price of gold, which at this recording, we're around 2600. So,
yeah.
Rick, it's pretty awesome.
It's been a good execution of the business model, and I have to give credit where it's due to Kinross for they are the manager, and they're managing the miners and the transportation and the mill, and it's a mill. One of the things I really like about Fort Knox is it's a mill that's been operating for 30 years. So
yeah,
now it's a different ore, so there's you've got to make adjustments, and they had to make capital investments at Fort Knox. So, and we're paying for that. We, the joint venture, are paying for that over time and all those details. But bottom line, it's just so much easier than trying to build your own mill, trying to permit your own mill.
Yeah.
In the United States, even on private land, it would probably take you at least 5 years to permit.
I was about to say 5 years.
Yes. And with outside NGOs, they're likely to challenge your wetlands permit. That would be probably one of the few federal permits that we would need for a tailings facility. Now we needed a wetlands permit to complete the road construction, but we disturbed 5.6 acres of wetlands. So for the Corps of Engineers, that's an easy bucket, right? If we built a tailings facility, we might have disturbed 500 acres in wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
Not so easy. And anyway, so that's the secret. I mean, it's not a big secret. The less you have to build, the less you have to permit. So effectively what we had to permit from the federal government was the road. Was going to disturb some wetlands, 5.6 acres. Again, relatively easy. Nothing's easy, but on a relative basis, that's not that hard. We needed a mine operating permit from the state of Alaska. And there's a whole detailed basket of other related permits, but fundamentally it was an air quality permit and all this, and just, if you're crossing a fish stream, you need a permit to do all these things. But the ones that hold you up are things like mine operating permit. But we got that in 9 months as well. So again, it's a simple quarry operation. So if we can continue to do that, with our Lucky Shot and our Johnson Tract projects, which we believe we can, and they have to meet the criteria, what makes a good DSO, direct shipping ore, work. Mm-hmm. It's grade. You have to have grade. So, that's why they say grade is king in our business. And I know some people try to convince other people that, oh no, it's about strip ratio and recovery and milling costs. And it's like, yeah.
It's
if you don't have grade, none of that really matters.
Yeah. You gotta have grade.
Grade's king. Close to existing infrastructure. So, these are, part of this comes from the lessons I've learned with Thalman. We found one of the biggest ore deposits, gold deposits on the planet, 40 million ounces, good grade, 2.2 grams for an open pit. It is a refractory ore, so you need lots of infrastructure and lots of power. And that's what's holding up the permitting.
Yeah.
It's because of just the scale of the project. And to get power there, you need to build a 320-mile gas line.
Yeah.
So
good luck.
After seeing all that, after we found Donlin over 25 years ago and it's still not permitted, I'm like, I'm not doing that again.
Mm-hmm.
So close to infrastructure, existing infrastructure.
How close?
Well, like I said, we had to build an 18, almost 20-mile road from the top of the hill for Moncho, from the top of the hill where the mine's located, mm-hmm. down to the highway.
So you got to build a road.
Yeah. So it was 20 miles. And again, if it's 20 miles across a swamp, that's probably going to be a lot of wetlands disturbance. So,
right.
But if it's 20 miles down a ridge line, it was only 5.6 acres.
Yeah.
So, diving into those details and understanding, what do you have to do to get permits? What permits do you need? And what do you have to do to get them?
Yeah.
And then the other one is land ownership. And what I, it's land ownership, and there's a few other things that go with that. And basically, how easy is it going to be to permit whatever it is that you have to permit? Road infrastructure to get up there, the mine site. So looking at things like water is always the most important thing of any mine. If you're in Chile, you don't have enough. And if you're in Alaska, you would usually have way too much.
Right, right.
So a mine at the top of a hill like Manh Choh, there's not a lot of water. Therefore, there's not a lot of wetlands. So there's not a lot of disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a 404 permit if they're not disturbing wetlands. If you're in the imp, i.e. if you're in the uplands. Are you above the water table or are you below the water table? Are you going to have to pump out a bunch of water? So those things are all criteria that we look at when we're looking at new projects. So when you look at, say, Lucky Shot, from private land.
I have it here on my notes. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's private land. It's above the water table. The underground, you can access the exploration site with a tunnel that we've now gotten all the way in and have our underground development in so we can start drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a fully permitted mine site. So again, not for just depositing tailings, because we don't plan to do that. We plan to just put rocks in a box and send them to a mill somewhere. We're 20 miles from the railroad, so there's another, you can drive a minivan up to the Lucky Shot. It's really, really
it's
easy,
easy
to get to. We'll have to, you know, make some road improvements.
Sure.
When we start, you know.
As always in Alaska.
With a truck, but I mean, it's just, you know.
It's easy access.
There's no real permitting left to do at Lucky Shot if we don't build a mill in the tailings facility and we just truck the ore somewhere.
Got it.
Or truck it down to the railroad and then rail it somewhere.
Got it. Let's talk about, you bought Johnson Tract, High Gold.
Yeah.
And that's where, and again, I want the viewers to understand this. And again, please correct me. Okay. It seems to me as an investor now, it's like you really bootstrapped it and you went from smaller. Okay. This is doable. We're going to hit cash. This is like a normal everyday business. Almost. It's just like, okay, I can see the money coming in. If we get this done. And now we're going to go for the Holy Grail, if you would. And that's what High Gold is. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scale up from, say,
right.
Well, it's actually the same size as Manh Choh.
Okay.
But you own size-wise,
though.
But we own all of it.
Right.
It meets all the criteria. So it's got grade. It's 9.4 grams per ton. It's relatively close to infrastructure because it's 20 miles to a barge landing.
Yeah. So it's about 120 miles from Anchorage, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, as the crow flies.
Yes.
And don't get me wrong. It's in a definitely remote location.
Yeah.
We have an airstrip and a camp and all that. So from an exploration standpoint, we're set up to do that business. But from a mining standpoint and from sending the ore somewhere, once you're underwater, things get pretty inexpensive. So 20 miles down to a barge landing is the same scale of infrastructure you have to put into develop Manh Choh. So it's not huge.
Uh-huh.
And it's on land owned by the Siri Native Corporation. And Siri has special rights with the federal government because Siri selected that land and allowed the federal government to create a park and preserve around it.
Okay.
So they have special access rights. So, that's knowing all those bits and pieces, we think this is a really good project and a good fit for us because it's basically this doing the same things that we just got through doing at Lucky Shot,
mm-hmm.
again at Johnson Tract, getting the tunnel permitted,
mm-hmm.
and so we can complete the exploration work. We started with the state of Alaska permitting the underground. Access.
So you've already started permitting.
Yeah, permitting started there. We finished the 404 permit for the road to the tunnel site.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 404 permit, so it was a federal permit with the Corps of Engineers. And that was, again, actually about the same, little, like 5.2 or 5.4 acres of wetlands disturbance. Again, small amount. But that took about 9 months, less than a year, to get done. In Alaska, the Corps of Engineers has been pretty pretty straightforward to deal with, as long as you're not trying to do something, you know, huge.
Yeah.
And that's, scale does matter in these things. And, you know, with a project like Donlin, there's a huge amount of, there's, you know, three different kinds of infrastructure that you need as a, with the gas line, the huge site, and then you're barging up and down the river. So there's, you know, that's a lot bigger footprint than a small mine site
in
the uplands that disturbs 5.2 acres of wetlands.
Yeah.
Let's take the pin out of share structure here.
Yeah.
So 13.1 million fully diluted. You had $36 million in cash. Please correct me if my figures are not right.
Nope, those are right.
So right there, it just shows me that you're very interested in protecting shareholder value. $36 million in cash, that's like a war chest in this business.
Now, we got to pay some bankers off.
Sure.
Well, I do want to make sure we cover that off.
Okay. So whatever the cost is, what's that? Maybe 10%? Okay. I'm just ballparking figures.
That's actually pretty accurate.
Okay.
10% money, which is, I think, pretty good for a company that's never had a mine before.
It's great. So you got a lot of money of cash in the bank. That money's going to be used to build this mine. Correct? Jackton Tractor, what's that going to be used for?
Over time. Yeah.
Over
so,
time.
You know, we just got to walk things through the process. So first order of business for Contango is to pay off our bankers. So we borrowed $60 million for our share of cash contribution, capital contribution to building Montrose.
Got it.
We paid off to date.
$8 million.
$8 million. So we're down to 52.
Okay.
Which is all reflected in the Q3 financials.
Okay.
Next year's objective is to pay down as much of the balance of the debt as we can. And in the corollary to borrowing the debt, there's separate legal agreements, but we also have hedges in place. The banks won't lend you money unless
you don't have a hedge.
Absolutely sure that they'll get their money back.
Right.
Which means hedging.
Yeah.
And obviously when this was done, this, you know, a couple of years ago, so
yeah.
You know, the gold price was, whether it was 1850 or whatever, and the hedges.
So your hedge at 2100.
2025.
Okay.
2025.
So I'm not trying to interrupt you, but yeah. Okay, so the hedges are coming off, or that we expired in 25, correct?
In early 26.
In early 26. Yeah. Okay. And is that for the entire company, or is that just for the different projects?
No, that's all.
Okay.
Montreux hedged ore.
Okay.
We've not hedged anything else.
Got it. Okay. What's your...
The exploration company should never hedge.
Yes. Right. But I mean, I can see it too, is like you financed almost all, if not all of this, and you did not hurt your shareholders. Again, that is such a huge story. Because, I mean, Rick, you've been in this business longer than me. I've been in this business since 94 as an investor, and I can't tell you how many times I've gotten screwed, pardon my friend, about people diluting me. Now, I am, as a shareholder, I'm not so much, dilution's going to happen, right? What's it going to? And are you being, what's the money going to? That's what I want to know. So
yeah, I mean,
that makes sense.
Yeah, for us, I mean, I like to take a huge amount of credit for not issuing a bunch of equity, but frankly, the equity markets just weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and because we had a high quality project, when you have 8 grams per ton at mm-hmm. Montrose, that's a high quality project. So, you know, lenders, they like the combination of assets. The fact that Kinross was the operator.
Mm-hmm.
Kinross has done this before. They're a big company. They know how to do things. You know, if it was, you know, Contango, me telling the lenders, oh, you know, Contango's going to go build this mine or operate this mine, they're going to go like, yeah, right. So, you know, part of it's the reason we did what we did was because the equity markets weren't there. If the equity markets were there, we probably would have raised more equity.
Okay.
Because the debt's not cheap, and
it
came with the hedging. We can't.
Yeah. It makes sense.
Yep. But yeah, as you know, the equity markets have just been kind of crap. And they're still, despite the gold price, they're still kind of crap.
Right.
But that's okay. We'll that's actually, I see that as an opportunity for us.
Yeah. So tell me about the plan, I guess, moving forward now is, yeah, what's the grand scheme in the sense you're going to, the Johnson Tract project, that is the, again, the Holy Grail. Are you looking to expand even outside of that and run that, or is that just at the top?
So we have a plan for, to drill a Lucky Shot. Give us 2 years, to get that project, 2-3 years, get that project where we want it to be, to be able to produce using the direct shipping model. And then Johnson Tract are 2-3 years behind that. So I call it kind of a 5-year plan to get both those projects up and running. And if, when they're up and running, as we envision them, this is a company that can be producing, 230,000 ounces of gold a year.
Yeah.
So that's a great objective. One of the key ingredients, along with doing the work to advance the projects to mine construction decisions, is where you're going to send this. If you're doing a DSO model, where's it going to go? So that's one of the other things that we're working on in the background. We've signed some CAs and we're evaluating a number of different opportunities of where the ore, this ore can go to. Oh, and by this ore, I mean Lucky Shot and Johnson Tract.
Got it. And are you looking to just sustain in Alaska? I'm assuming so. But
No, actually, I think I'd say West Coast. We'll probably look at other things eventually, but I think Alaska, BC, I think Yukon's going to be on hold a little bit in my mind still. Wasn't really pleased with how the Yukon government handled the situation there at the Eagle Mine. So that,
yep.
That just, I think they got to sort out a few things.
Yeah.
Before I'd feel really comfortable spending a lot of money there, frankly. It's,
yeah.
But BC and, there's certainly a few other things in Alaska, but in all honesty, we have a lot going on right now. So I'm not like in a hurry to go out and, do something else unless it's synergistic with, Johnson Tract and Lucky Shot. So that's kind of the focus is, are there some opportunities out there that are synergistic with those projects? Then that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, Rick, I can't thank you enough for coming to Atlanta to see me. I enjoyed my first talk that we had in Florida, and I've enjoyed this. And again, I can't tell you enough about just how much I appreciate just your projects and your common sense of getting these projects into production. And then you caring about Alaska as an Alaskan, that means a great deal to me. And then also caring about me as a shareholder and just really protecting my value. And again, it's not that you haven't diluted. As you said, that might have been the best option, but it's really taking the best option as a shareholder. It's like, I trust that, if that makes sense. And I just really...
It will change over time.
Sure,
Course. Hopefully we do get a market where...
It's favorable.
...equity values... or whether equity shareholder, where shareholder equity is valued,
yes,
for its exploration potential. We don't have that in this market
yet. Yeah. And that's when it makes sense.
So you have to kind of act appropriately, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I trust. And so I appreciate that. So, Rick, if people want to buy a Contango ore, where do they go? Wichita's symbol?
So the symbol CTGO, we trade on the NYC American. We don't trade in Canada. So you have to go to the US.
That's where I bought it. That's the only place you can buy it.
We're trading, I don't know, 80,000-ish shares a day, I think is the average now for a while. We still want to continue to get the story out. We have been what I would kind of describe as a friends and family story. We've trying to do a fair bit of marketing and just came back from Europe. We've been marketing, doing some marketing there. And
how'd it go?
I think good. I think pretty positive in Zurich, and that's a really gold focus group of investors there.
Yeah.
So I think they, just kind of brush it off as a bit of a blip, but it's nice to see gold up solidly today. So
it was up today. Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned all that. Not that I'm an investor. Well, I'm an investor and a trader. I look at charts and I was like, today, not a recommendation, but I was like, well, I've been looking at you for several months. I was like, this is a buy today. Not a recommendation. That was for my own funds. And so I pulled the trigger finally. So it was good for me. So Rick, I want to thank you so much. I'll put the ticker and your website in the show notes as well as in the cards on the YouTube. And again, it's a pleasure talking to you. And I look forward to our next chat.
Good seeing you again.
Good seeing you.